Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User-Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User-Friendly 2.0. Welcome to this week's show. We got some schedule changes this week. Emerald City Comic Con is postponing to this summer, and the Game Developers Conference has been canceled. We'll talk about that. Also got an interview with William Defoe, but first we are going to look at the news. The news today is sponsored by my friends over at We Are Technology. WeAreTechnology.com is your one-stop shop for websites, interactive programming, phone apps, you name it, they can do it on the internet. What's in the news today?
Emerald City Comic Con postponed until summer.
Yes, we're not there, and we're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit of a bummer. From Emerald City's press office, they really, and I think they really did, try to keep the show going as it was planned for this weekend, but just in the best interest, and especially since the Seattle area has kind of been ground zero for the coronavirus outbreak, they have decided, but it's important to point out that from what they're saying is it's not a cancellation, it's a postponement. They're working on securing new dates for the summer, and I can only imagine what would be involved in rescheduling a show like that.
Oh, that'd be a nightmare.
I mean, vendors and performers and guests and oh my goodness. So,
and the scheduling. Ugh.
So I think we all from User Friendly wish them the best on this. And I know this is hard too on the small vendors that make their money off of these shows, you know, having it all of a sudden delayed like this. And, you know, I just really hope everything works out for everybody. But we will be there this summer. That is our plans. As soon as we know the dates, we will let you know.
Intel chips have an unfixable security flaw.
Well, that's a bummer. So what's happened here? If you have a computer with an Intel chip that was made in the last 5 years, there's a problem. But in my opinion, it's serious, but it's not as serious as it could be. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But what it is a research firm has found that the chipsets used in Intel computers over the past 5 years have a flaw that allows hackers to bypass encryption codes and quietly install malware such as keyloggers. And the worst news, there's no complete fix to the problem. What Intel's trying to do is address this by patching the software around it, because it's a hard-coded vulnerability in the boot ROM and something that is not easily changed without physically changing hardware. The one thing that I would say that makes me think of this is not as big of a deal as it could be, is they're saying that you have to be in physical proximity to the computer in order to exploit this. So it's not something that necessarily can come in from on the internet. But one of the things that's kind of bad for Intel on this is AMD has been making a lot of inroads into the chip market lately, and they've got a lot of really good products. So to have something like this come out that's a pretty intense flaw is not a good thing for diehard Intel users like me. So hopefully they'll be able to get this fixed. I think they're going to take care of it in the new versions of the hardware, but it is just something to be aware of.
Well, guess what? T-Mobile hacked again.
Well, that's a shock. So this time it's T-Mobile's email system, internal email system. This isn't as major as them getting all of the user accounts and passwords and some of the things that have happened to a lot of these companies in the past, but there is still the chance that some personal client information got out if it happened to be contained in their emails. So recommendation is to check your passwords and do all of the normal stuff where see if there's anything unusual going on your account. The worst part of this is more so than someone being able to really get into your cell phone per se is the fact that with personal information that they can go and maybe take out credit accounts or do something like that. So just as a part of the new normal, and I think that's really what it is now, keep an eye on your bank accounts, keep an eye on everything, just be vigilant. Because there's been so many hacks and so many leaks lately that we're at a point right now where it's more a containment instead of a trying to prevent it scenario.
Apparently, the coronavirus is being used for phishing attacks.
Yeah, and you know, our hearts go out to everybody that's being affected by this. It is definitely something that the world has their eyes on, and it's creating some things. And especially with the vulnerable elderly and other groups of people that have medical issues, this can be deadly. A lot of other people seem to be getting it, but recovering from it, but all the way around, it's unpleasant, and it is something that seems to be spreading. And now the bad guys have figured out a way to use this to get to your personal information, and what they're doing is generating emails that look official from official organizations, different things like that, trying to get you to click on a link. It's the age-old scam, just a new twist on it. So like always, if you get an email and you don't know who it's from, or even if you do, don't click on the link in the email. If you want to get to that information, open your browser, go to the website yourself. If it's a banking type thing or something else, or even a medical thing now with this, maybe call your provider, call your bank, find out if it really came from them. Most reputable companies don't do weird things through the email, and if it feels off, it probably is. Err on the side of caution, and if it turns out that it was real, then, well, you made an extra phone call and you were sure.
FCC to require anti-robocall tech.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about this in our Tech Wednesday this week. And what this is last year, we talked about it here on our show, legislation was passed to do something called Stir Shaken, kind of an odd name. But what?
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, I don't know where they came up with that. Actually, I do, but it's hard to explain. But the point of it being is that what they want to do is require certain parameters so that your caller ID is accurate. The idea being that a lot of these robocallers use caller ID spoofing to give you a phone number from a credible source, sometimes even your own, to get you to answer the phone, kind of like the phishing email, but on the phone. And last year, they had put out that they wanted an opt-in volunteer scenario from the tech companies, cell phone providers, that type of thing, to implement these procedures so that things would be more secure. Well, guess what? It doesn't seem to have worked out.
Well, you mean nobody volunteered to install that software?
I wouldn't say nobody, but it definitely has not been implemented on a enterprise-wide scale like we would have hoped.
Shocking.
So, yeah, I'm just here shocked by that fact. So, the FCC on March 31st at their next meeting is considering an act to make this a requirement. If at first volunteering doesn't succeed, sometimes you have to go in that direction and it's kind of too bad. But I do think the robocalls are the most complained about thing to the FCC. It's in the billions every year.
Well, yeah.
You know, sometimes they're just annoying, but a lot of times they can be dangerous, scam you out of money, that kind of thing. And I know you guys have even dealt with this a little bit.
Yeah, especially my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I get another call telling me that my Windows is running and that I need to give them some sort of code from it to help fix it, I'm gonna just, you know,
yes.
Freak out.
And that's where this is going. One of the other ones is that your social security number has been compromised and you will be arrested unless you do whatever,
yeah.
Which seems to require providing a whole bunch of personal information and generally sending money. And with these type of things, again, it's like with the email. If you get a call and you're concerned about it, call your financial institution, but get the phone number from a reputable source like their documentations or their website. Do not call a number back that's on these voicemails. It is definitely a dangerous thing, and it ends up scamming a lot of people out of a lot of money. In fact, as a for example, the popular TV show Shark Tank, one of the sharks almost got scammed out of $400,000 due to this type of a situation. And she figured it out, was able to call the bank, and they were able to freeze the money, fortunately. But it happens to even the most experienced in the financial world. So don't be embarrassed if it happens, but do get on it right away. It's very, very important to get these things worked out. So in our blog article this week over at theanswerportland.com, Gretchen, you've put some things together. Should you find yourself stuck in a quarantine or a situation where you have to be by yourself, what do you do?
Well, some of the things that we were coming up with is you could always binge watch some television shows that you haven't seen in a long time. Like some of the old Star Trek series.
The Witcher, The Crown, anything on Amazon. You got all the stuff on Disney Plus. There's Hulu and YouTube.
Okay, so a lot of internet content. That sounds like a good idea. And just make sure your internet is working.
Yeah.
So if your internet's not working, you might have a collection of DVDs or video games, board games, card games. And the thing is well, if you're with friends, maybe a few family members, whoever it is, you might be able to do some D&D.
Yeah, role-playing games are always fun for this type of thing and a good time killer. And have some fun with bringing this stuff out and some actual social interaction. Now, they're saying that social distancing is a good thing, stay at least a meter or yard apart. But if you're with your family, like you say, or that type of thing, or in a situation. And some of these games, if you find that you're by yourself, you can even do online. We've kind of tested out some of the role-playing games and that type of thing. Now, personally, I still prefer them in person. But either way, something definitely to do. Now, for those that aren't into gaming, what are some of the things they might look at?
Well, I was thinking perhaps learn something new. Try something different. Drawing, knitting, embroidery, jewelry making, fly a kite, go outside. You know, you're still alone.
Yeah. Now, I've been told to go fly a kite on numerous occasions. Is this because of this?
Yes, well, you know.
Yes. They think you're a virus.
Yeah, there you are. Kite. No, but actually learning a new thing, check out a new hobby, that type of thing. And, you know, in this day and age, if you don't want to go out, you can order everything and have it delivered right to your door to try something out. Although those resources are definitely available. And so that way, you know, kind of take away from the cabin fever thing a little bit. But if you find that you want to go outside and, you know, not get close to other people, there's some things you might be able to do.
Yeah, you could even do some home improvements like gardening. Paint your house, you know.
Inside, or, outside. Paint the fence.
Yeah.
And what about the old-fashioned thing? Read a book.
Read a book. You know?
Not a book.
What's new is old again, right?
Or
what's old is
new again. There's always comic books. They got great pictures. If you've got a collection, go back, look through them.
Actually, I need to go look through my books. There's a couple of series I want to get back into.
Yeah, you know, that type of thing is actually a very good point. I know cabin fever, especially, and I feel for some of these people that have had to quarantine for 14 days. In fact, some of our friends have ended up dealing with that, so it's a little closer connection than one might think. So all things that to work on doing. This is User Friendly 2.0. Check out the blog online. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. G is joining us now with his special guest, William Dafoe.
William Dafoe is an amazing actor and one of the best character actors in the business. He has 4 Oscar nominations, 3 Golden Globe nominations. The year he should have won both is 2001 for his work in The Shadow of the Vampire, which we'll cover a little later. Some of the award-nominated work isn't all that recognizable to most of you. There aren't films that ended up in art houses and major markets, but he's done some stuff you may know about. He was in Aquaman, Murder on the Orient Express, John Wick, The Fault is in Our Stars, XXX, State of the Union, Speed 2, Clear and Present Danger, Mississippi Burning. I interviewed Dafoe in December of last year about the movie The Lighthouse. Now, the buzz at the time was that The Lighthouse would end up in the Best Picture categories, and Dafoe and his co-star Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame would also get nominations. Well, that didn't happen. Still, it's a very good movie and an intense black and white movie, and one you can now see on DVD. The movie's about a couple of guys managing a lighthouse. Dafoe's in charge, Pattinson's the flunky. Both men have secrets, don't really like each other, but they have to get along. And the lighthouse pairing is ugly and tough to watch, but it's also 2 very, very good performances. The film was done by Robert Eggers, who did The Witch. Dafoe loved the movie, wanted to work with him.
Well, I was very attracted to the, after seeing The Witch, I wanted to work with Rob Eggers. I told him so. We met, we got along fabulously, and he said, yeah, let's try to find something to do together. And then a little while later, he called me up one day, said, I think I have the project. I'm going to send it to you. Take a look at it. It's you, Rob Pattinson. Read it. Tell me what you think, yes or no. Basically that.
It's set on a cold and dreary island with a lighthouse. The weather was rainy and windy when they were filming it, and it's a very desolate and depressing place, so it's perfect for the kind of drama that was done in this movie. But still, it had to be a very, very difficult movie to make.
It gives you your performance. That's the gift it gives. It's a character. You know, it really tells you how to behave and puts you in a certain frame of mind. You know, you could not shoot this in a... you could not have this same story. It wouldn't be the same story in a, you know, Lighthouse in the Caribbean. It's about that weather. So... Or, you know, there's so many things that, you know, you can't really act cold, not like you can be cold. So it's not pleasant, but you welcome it because it really defines what you're doing. That's the experience.
Dafoe's co-star Pattinson has been working pretty hard the last few years to distance himself from the vampire Edward. He's succeeded in tossing off that teen idol pretty boy image, and he's dug into some terrific parts. Pattinson's work in the film is very intense, and it's very, very good. And by the way, Pattinson has been tabbed to be the next Batman, and that film is being shot as I speak. But for The Lighthouse, Pattinson seemed to have the more difficult and more physical part. He worked hard. He toiled in the rain and the mud. It was a grueling and very physically demanding role, and a fact that was not lost on Defoe.
You know, he was good. He was good. It takes two to tango. I mean, we helped each other. We had very different ways of working, but I think it was good casting, and I think he does a good job.
Obviously, when an actor has made as many films as Willem Dafoe, and some very, very good ones, I might add, they love the business. Says he really didn't intend on becoming a star, it just kind of happened.
I just went towards people and towards situations. I knew I liked performing. I started performing when I was really young, you know, as an amateur and, you know, community theater and then semi-professional theater. And then I started working with an avant-garde theater company in the Midwest. And someone saw me and invited me to New York. I came to New York and started working with the Wooster Group, where I worked for 30 years almost. And people saw me in the theater there and started asking me to do movies. And that's kind of how it happened. So I never had a great plan. I was just tried to be places that and be with people that inspired me and interested me.
That leads to another question. Why be an actor and what does it give you?
Pleasure, curiosity, a life where work is never the same, a nomadic life, a life that you can't quite know where it's going.
And plus you get to be different people.
Right, which is fantastic. You get to entertain, you know, different lives or imagine them, try to embody them and have experiences that, aren't life, but approximated.
He does a lot of very difficult and complex characters. I've always wondered how actors separate the character they play from real life once the camera stops rolling.
Because, you know, it's pretend. And when you're there, it's like you enter another universe. So you have that understanding. That's the nature of play. It's just like, you know, if acting is basically at its heart pretending, I mean, it's like little kids, you know? They yeah. say, okay, you play the cop, I play the robber, and then, you know, they go to it and they fight. They have no problem with, you know, they can separate the playtime with their regular life. So can we.
I always ask actors or directors or writers who inspired them. Defoe gave me one of the most unusual answers I've ever received. He said his inspiration is people you've never heard of, the people who helped him get where he is today. But what I really wanted to know, and by the way, I really admired that answer. What I really wanted to know, though, was what actors inspired him once he started taking acting seriously.
I always liked actors that didn't seem like actors, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes they were movie stars, but, you know, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with Gone with the Wind, for example, and I thought Clark Gable, he wasn't credible at all in that period, but I loved watching him, and I loved the movie. And then as I got older, I tended to like character actors that didn't seem like actors, people like Warren Oates or Harry Dean Stanton, people like that.
And that leads to my favorite Willem Dafoe film, and the one that should have won him an Oscar and a Golden Globe. It's called The Shadow of the Vampire, and I think it's the best work he ever did. Should have won both the Oscar and the Golden Globe and a bunch of other awards. Instead, the award went to Benicio del Toro for Traffic. Poor choice on everybody's part. Anyway, Dafoe loved that movie, too.
That was an excellent character, and it was a lot of fun to do. And also, it was so extreme that it's one of those movies, kind of like The Lighthouse, where I don't even recognize myself.
Yeah.
You know, when I watch it, he's another person. It's like, who is that? I feel that very much with Shadow the Vampire, because, of course, literally, I'm transformed by the makeup.
Thank you, Willem Dafoe.
This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. This is the section of the show where you get to ask us your questions. And boy, have we had a lot of questions lately. Last week, we actually did a little longer segment. We'll be doing that once in a while because we're getting so many good questions. And keep sending them in. One User Friendly on Facebook and Twitter, 503-766-6264. What's our first question today, Jeremy?
Why do I have to pay sales tax on eBay all of a sudden?
Well, because the government wants their money.
Oh, well.
So what this is this started October 1st of last year. So last fall, eBay has started collecting sales tax on transactions for buyers. So this is based on where you're buying, not where you're selling. In Arizona, California, Colorado, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Nevada, North Dakota, South Dakota, Texas, and Utah. They take care of collecting the sales tax and getting it to the appropriate authorities so you don't have to worry about it, which is a good thing. But on a broader sense, this goes along with the fact that a lot of states are trying to get their sales tax because it's a hit in their revenue on online sales. So this was something that we kind of knew would show up eventually, and it now has.
All right. What kind of smartwatch do you recommend?
Yeah, there's a couple of them out there, and I went through a number of different ones trying to find a good one. I used to have a Samsung Gear, which I really liked. The only thing that was kind of a negative about it is it was old enough that it wouldn't work with the newer phones. So when I replaced my Samsung phone, I couldn't use my watch anymore. Now, Gretchen, you have a smartwatch. What do you have?
I have a Fitbit. Versa 2, I think?
Yep, Versa 2. And what do you think of it?
I really like it. It's been really fun. I don't think I understand completely how to use it, but it's doing all of the tracking, and it tells time, and it's got a bunch of other features. I have no idea what they do. But, you know,
I mean, it's a watch that tells time. That's a little weird. But
the battery also lasts a long time, the charge.
Yeah. I have the older version of the Fitbit Versa, the one, as it would be. And it's the same type of thing. So you wouldn't necessarily think of that as a smartwatch. At least I didn't initially. But it's kind of a combination of a fitness tracker and a smartwatch. So it has the pedometer and all the other functions for exercise. It has an app that syncs up and is reasonably good to work with. I kind of like the Samsung one a little bit better, but it works. And the watch itself has a lot of cool functions. I can either load my Starbucks card to it and pay for my coffee. So, you know, that's what's important.
Woohoo! Okay, are there really radio-free zones in the United States?
So this question comes all the way from North Virginia. And to explain what this is, and the listener was actually questioning whether this was a thing, it is. So a radio-free zone is a section, a geographical section, where they do not allow radio waves. So no Wi-Fi, no radio, no tele, you know, all that kind of stuff is blocked. Now, the reason that these exist, at least this one, is because of a radio telescope. And if they have radio waves, ground RF interference from it, from cell phones and everything else, you end up in a situation where the telescope doesn't function correctly because it interferes with it. So there's actually a radius around the telescope where you aren't even allowed to use Bluetooth and those type of things. And then further where there's no cell phones and people that live in this area. In fact, I'm going to try to get an interview with somebody in the next couple of weeks about this. It's kind of a very interesting modern upbringing where you don't have Wi-Fi. There's still phone booths, you know, these kind of things, even though it's 2020. So this is a real thing. It does exist. The observatory is open to the public and is something that's worth checking out. But if you go there, be prepared. You're not going to have a cell phone. Might be kind of nice.
What is Bitbucket?
So without any of the words you're not supposed to say on the radio, what is your opinion of that, Gretchen? Or the product?
Frustrating, scary.
Yeah,
frustrating.
So the answer to the question, Bitbucket is an online website that's designed for holding source code repositories. So for anybody that's not a programmer, when you write computer software, there's something called the source code. It's the version in your language that we understand to be able to tell the computer what we want it to do. And there are services, of which Bitbucket is one main one, GitHub is another one, that are out there that programmers use for keeping track of source code. And one of the things that it does that's really cool is if you have updates and stuff, you can revert back. And other people use this for things like, oh, writing books to be able to prove when the book was originally written and keep track of revisions. So it doesn't have to just be source code, but it is definitely something that is used by a lot of people for it. It is not intuitive to learn how it works, but once you do get it to work, it's actually pretty cool. Would you agree with that, Gretchen?
Yeah, you have to use it on a regular basis, you know, to remember, because it's not intuitive.
There's several online classes on YouTube and other places that give instructions on how to do it. So if you find yourself needing this, I would say check it out first. Otherwise, it could be a very frustrating experience. This is User-Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User-Friendly 2.0. She and Dr. Lindman are going to join us to talk a little bit about all the hoarding that's going on lately with the coronavirus concerns. If you've been to the store recently, you might find that some of the basic staples like toilet paper, hand sanitizer, that type of things are picked over or gone. So let's find out why.
Thank you, Bill. I'm with Dr. Linda Lindman, a neuropsychologist practicing in the state of Washington. And thanks for coming on the show, Linda. Before we get into panic buying, what's neuropsychology?
Neuropsychology is the study of the relationship between brain and behavior, specifically looking at brain function, how it affects people's behavior, the consequences of trauma or disease.
So, you know, a lot of testing involved in this?
Yes, it relies almost completely on testing. There are full batteries of neuropsychological tests that tell us how the brain functions, how it works, things such as attention, concentration, memory, short-term, long-term, processing speed, perception, visual, spatial types of perception, executive functioning, those kinds of things.
So what you're telling me is the brain's a fairly complicated machine.
It's a very complicated machine, and we still don't understand quite how it works.
In some cases, I'm not sure it works at all, especially in my case. But I've always been really curious. So what do you do with all these tests then?
Well, we give the test in order to answer specific questions about a person's perceived impairments, their cognition, their way of understanding the world. The way they're able to express themselves. It aids in deciding things like educational placement. It aids in providing information to people who work in rehabilitation to help brain function.
Do we use it very well as a society?
Well, I think that we do use it. There's a shortage of neuropsychologists, and not many people are able to afford the service of a neuropsychologist, or their insurance may not cover it, but there's a lot of information that can be gained, and then the person can be sent in the right direction to get the most help possible for whatever is going on with them.
So how would you use the data? I mean, let's say I had some kind of a... in one of your tests, you found something amiss in my brain. How would you use that data? And then how do you use the data as a whole?
Well, by collecting the data that we have and knowing, for instance, what kind of disease or injury a person has had, we can then predict what might happen given that disease in another person. We also can study the effect of different medications on brain function. So the information is used in a lot of different ways. It also helps us understand human behavior when we know what part of the brain is responsible for certain behavior, what sort of chemical imbalances result in depression or anxiety or that kind of thing. So the data is used widely, and it's of great benefit to people.
So you talked about disease a minute ago. So the disease we're talking about now is the coronavirus. A lot of people are out buying too much toilet paper. So I don't understand why you need a whole lot of toilet paper during a pandemic, but maybe you do. So tell me about panic buying. You did some study about this for me this week. Tell me about it.
Well, panic buying happens in response to fear. Human beings are made so that they either fight, flee, or freeze whenever they have fear of something happening. So we haven't removed ourselves from the threat of this virus. It's happening. It's coming. I think we're taking steps now where people will be confined to their homes and they won't be able to be around the virus to prevent the spread. But what we're doing in panic buying is it's kind of like the fight response. We're preparing. We're preparing ourselves. We're taking back control because we don't really have control over this virus. And so we're in fear of it. So the only way we can exercise control is to prepare ourselves for shortages or for necessities that maybe we can't get to. So that's why people go out and they buy very functional type things to prepare for the shortages. And of course, toilet paper is pretty functional and everybody needs it. So we go and we take all the toilet paper off the shelves. We take the hand sanitizers. We take bleach. We get anything we can that will help ensure our survival through this period. And it's also done because of the widespread social media, the information there. When we see other people emptying the shelves, we develop a fear that none is going to be there for us. So we run out and we buy it too. When we see other people buying things, emptying the shelves, or we see people engaging in certain behaviors, we assume that they probably know something that we don't. They know more than we do. And we have to get in on it or it creates great anxiety for us. So that's why people are emptying the shelves. We are preparing for this emergency that we know little about.
What strikes me is you can't eat toilet paper or hand sanitizer. So like if I was going to be heading for the store, I'd be buying food. So like I know a lot of people who talk about how much gold they have for an emergency. You know, if the country collapses, I have gold, but you can't eat gold.
Can't eat gold, but you sure can trade it for things. And I bet if you're in dire straits, you could trade that toilet paper for something else. But it's a necessity. Yeah. So, you know, most people want to have toilet paper on hand. If they can't get to the store or if the shelves are empty, what do? So they stockpile.
That was a little bit of toilet humor there. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And for this insightful thing as to why I'm hoarding. And by the way, I have a truckload of toilet paper. I mean, that kind of leads to, is there, you know, like some kind of an underground toilet paper network or something? Anyway, I'll give it back to Bill.
This is User-Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. Great show this week. Loved our interview. That was really cool. So we're going to keep everybody updated on the schedule of upcoming events. Again, we've already talked about this, but Emerald City Comic Con got postponed to this summer. Dates to be forthcoming. The Game Developers Conference got canceled. I don't know if they're rescheduling that or not. So as soon as we know, we will let you know on our social media. How do you get to that? One User Friendly on Facebook and Twitter. userfriendlyshow.com. TheAnswerPortland.com is where our podcasts are, and some of our announcements are there as well. And I want to take a little time in our conclusion today to talk about one other listener question that should get some dedicated focus on. And that the question was, what is a Raspberry Pi? And the obvious answer, is
food.
Food, yes.
It's a with raspberries in it. I mean, Come on, really. It says it right there in the name.
And it's got a flaky crust.
Yeah. So, and being someone that likes Raspberry Pi maybe a little bit too much, it is, kind of fun from both directions. But this is actually a thing, and it's something that you can get. A lot of hobbyists use it. It's actually a small computer. So you can load it on. It actually will do things like run Windows or Linux or most of our operating systems, but it's a little tiny thing that's used for projects where you can build your own thing. It and competitors out there do things like run robotics or do Internet of Things, smart things projects and that type of thing. And just with, you know, having to talk about that we may end up in a situation here where we're indoors for a little while with coronavirus, something that you might look into doing if you're interested in these type of things. And Jeremy, I know you've worked with some of this hobbyist stuff on the 3D printer. Now, was that a Raspberry Pi or was that one of the other ones?
That was a Raspberry Pi Nano.
Nano, okay.
I mean, that's like the tiniest piece I've seen so far.
So there are different versions of this. And yeah, if you want to get one just to play with, you can get a board, load it with the operating system. Everything works with flash RAM, like SD cards, that type of thing. You can actually buy little tiny touch screens that go with them and that stuff. But I have actually seen production projects made out of these devices. They have USB and Ethernet generally built in. Wi-Fi is now a standard part of it in the new version of it. There's four. We're on version four now. So there's a lot of different things. If you're a hobbyist, you can go online. There's a lot of resources for being able to see different projects just to get used to actually building something and getting into the hardware end of it a little bit. And Jeremy, what did you use yours for?
We built using four different pieces,
a modification.
It was a tag reader, infrared tag reader.
Okay.
We would put information on the little infrared tag so that I could run non-standard 3D printer material through my DaVinci Junior.
Okay, so it was a way to be able to reprogram that.
Yeah, and so it would read a tag. It has a 3D a reader in the spool support inside the machine.
Okay.
So most spools don't fit in there. So you'd have to stick it on the outside of the machine and run the filament through it. But it would always say, well, there's no filament here. So you had to have built a little, there's like four things you had to print. And one of them was a little thing that sat underneath the reader so that the tag would be right there where it could read it and say, hey, this is a spool of whatever material and it's this long and you know, cooks at this temperature and how much material is there.
All right. So one use for many. Don't necessarily recommend that idea. I know you've had some trouble with your print head too.
I did.
But, you know, at the end of the day, there's all kinds of different things and all kinds of different projects. Check it out. Something to do if you're stuck in. This is User-Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User-Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2020 User-Friendly Media Group, Inc. The views and opinions expressed in this show are those of the host and not necessarily User-Friendly Media Group, Inc. or this station. Music licensing by BMI. Hosting provided by WeAreTechnology.com. Podcast available at theanswerportland.com or userfriendlyshow.com.